Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. That's jackandrea.com. The Morning Show is next.
And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, we are paying tribute to Dr. John D. Bunker, who for 33 years was a highly regarded history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. In fact, he began teaching at Parkside just 2 years after the campus opened. Professor Bunker died on April 4th. And we are remembering him today not only as a very fine teacher, but also as a superb historian and the author of several wonderful books about the progressive movement in America, as well as a fascinating book about the city that he called home for half a century, Racine, the book titled Invention City, the Sesquicentennial History of Racine. On today's Morning Show, we are replaying the conversation I had with Professor Bunker in early February 2001, shortly after the incredibly close victory of George Bush over Al Gore in that presidential election. Here is our conversation. Professor John Bunker, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thanks, Ray. It's great. Always a pleasure to be here.
We're really glad to have you here. The last time you were here, it was the day after the election, and it's kind of interesting to try to replay the sense of bewilderment that swept the country in the aftermath of one of the most amazing, if not the most amazing, presidential elections in our history.
Yeah, well, of course, we had no idea at that point what a long, strange trip it was going to be before they finally came to the end. But it certainly took a lot of twists and turns over the years. And in some ways, there are certain precedents for what happened, you know, as a historian. But there are also some things, I think, that have never happened before.
Right. In fact, that's one of the things I wanted to explore, because to me at the time, that was among the most interesting things, is that you'd turn on television and see a panel of experts often kind of shaking their heads, not really being able to say with any certainty, well, this means this, well, I think this is next. I mean, this was in some ways very uncharted territory. Why don't you tell us what was unprecedented about this election and the way in which the results were finally resolved?
Well, I think probably the most unprecedented thing was the involvement of the courts in it. I mean, I can't think of another election in American history where the courts played, both state and federal, played such a key role. And, of course, at the very end, it was a decision of the Supreme Court that finally brought the election to a conclusion. Generally, it's something that's fought out in Congress, if it gets to that point, because there have been several elections that have ended up going into the House of Representatives and being decided there, but none of them have ever gone beyond that and into the courts. And then there were the question of the various deadlines, you know, what really was the election and when did you really have to certify it? I don't think that, of course, actually the longest case was the 1876 election, which most people probably heard about during the discussions of this thing.
That's really, Rutherford B. Hayes?
Yes, that wasn't really decided, actually, until about a couple days before the inauguration, after a congressional panel had spent several months sifting through the evidence of three southern states, one of which, of course, was Florida, which maybe a coincidence, but it's it's such a wonderful coincidence, it's hard to ignore.
Yeah.
And of course, that took place during the during the Reconstruction period, when there was a great fight over the 15th Amendment and the racial questions, and obviously a lot of ballot box stuffing and intimidation of voters and so on. So it was a much different period than now, it would seem, and the stakes were quite a bit different, the issues were somewhat different and so on. But I think the main thing for me is that I think that this election kind of pointed up certain problems with the way we elect the president. I don't think most people realize, for example, the tremendous variation in the ballot and the procedures and so on for actually getting the ballots counted. And I mean, I think that in the long run, I think that's probably one of the most important things we need to do is take a look at that. I think we need a standardized ballot, at least for president. I mean, I think that so that everyone across the country is using the same kind of ballot. And then I think also we probably need more effective poll watching and so on for presidential elections. And I mean, we have this, you know, we have a long tradition of local control over elections and so forth, and of course tremendous local variation. And I guess I don't have too much problem with that if you're talking about state offices or even congressional seats or whatever, but the president's the only office that's elected nationwide. It seems to me we should have nationwide standards, I would think, and nationwide procedures and so forth. But even the courts have always been very reluctant to do that. I mean, even during the 60s with the Voting Rights Acts and so forth, I mean, they always stopped short of really making federalizing the whole process. I mean, it's still basically done by the states. But I think that, you know, this surely needs to be looked at, and some changes and it need to take place. As you're probably aware, there are various groups still counting the votes in Florida. Mm. The other side of that is that, you know, one has always suspected that not too many elections would really bear the kind of scrutiny that that they were getting in Florida. In other words, I think if you went into most elections and really started looking and carefully counting and so on, we're saved from that problem because most elections aren't that close, and so people say, well, you know, it's not going to make too much difference. But when you get a really narrow outcome like this and people really start looking at it, you begin to realize that there are a lot of judgments that are made about which ballots gets counted and which ones don't, and machines that malfunction or something of that sort, and the ballots get tossed out, or, you know, like I think most states have very different rules and even very flexible rules about counting absentee ballots, for example, you know, some of which get counted, some of which don't for whatever reason. And I think a lot of those weaknesses were really pointed out. The question, of course, becomes whether when you have a crisis like this, there's a lot of discussion about doing something about it, but then as the time lag goes on, people tend to forget about it and say, well, that's not going to happen again for another 50 years or something, you know. So I guess the same thing applies to Electoral College. There was a lot of discussion about that at the time, you know, looking into it and maybe either abolishing the Electoral College or revising it some fashion or other, but, you know, that talk seems to have died down considerably.
It's amazing how much of that kind of talk has died down. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised in that, I mean, it's not really in anybody's living memory that we've had an election where the winner of the popular vote was the loser of the electoral vote, and so you actually had more people voting for Al Gore, but Al Gore losing the election. I mean, that hasn't happened since the 19th century, correct?
Since the 1880s, yeah.
Yeah.
The last time, yeah.
And I guess I would have predicted more of an uproar over that, and it kind of surprised me that Americans took that kind of a result as much in stride as they did.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting situation. Partly, I think, because most people, I think, didn't even know that there was such a thing as the Electoral College, I don't think, and they had no idea how it functioned, I don't think. And in fact, I was talking to some of my students the other night right after class, and with my colleague, Professor Hayward, we team teach a course on Wednesday nights, and we were talking about the fact that before the election, it was Gore who was trying to prepare people for the fact that he might win an electoral vote victory with a popular vote loss, and then, of course, it turned out to be just the other way around. But I think for a while it made a lot of people aware of the role that the Electoral College system really plays, and, you know, the initial reaction that a lot of people had was, well, you know, this doesn't seem fair that we should just have a straight popular election and so on. But then there were a lot of people who began to present counter arguments to that. And as I say, once the thing was decided, it seems like everybody just kind of moved on. I recall a similar excitement over the 1960 election, I think. And I think Birch Bayh, who was then a senator from Indiana, introduced a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College, which actually was debated in Congress, and I think it obviously was never adopted, but it was there was a lot of discussion in the academic world and in the political world about the pros and cons of this. So it appears that the people most opposed to direct election are the smaller states, because they feel like the presidential candidates would completely ignore them. But that's kind of a strategy, because I remember distinctly in 1960 that Kennedy concentrated entirely on the populous states, whereas Nixon went around and campaigned in he promised, in fact, that he would campaign in every one of the 50 states. And so Nixon found himself painted into a corner at the end of the election. He was trying to make good his promise by campaigning in places like Montana, while Kennedy was holding rallies in Philadelphia and Chicago and New York and so forth, and turning out, you know, massive votes, as any Democratic candidate would have to do in those cities. So I'm not sure that really follows. It's more a matter of, I think it's a matter of electoral strategy more than anything else, whether you're going to concentrate on the, plus the other thing is, you know, I mean, like it or not, that's the way our population is tending. I think like 75% of the population lives on about 5% of the landmass.
I think of the maps that were published in a lot of places. I first saw it, I think, in USA Today, but a map that showed county by county whether they went Gore or Bush, and Bush was red and Gore was blue, and you look at that map, and the overwhelming majority of that map was red, and the entire center of it,
but then red.
Yes. Yeah, but then around the edges, and of course the very populous metropolitan areas, those were blue, and it just crystallized the divide in this country. It seems to me that's another legacy of this election, is that it got us really talking about who we are and what kind of a nation we are, and our differences and our similarities and so on. We kind of examined ourselves in some ways that maybe we hadn't in a while, or the general public was doing that.
Yeah, I think people recognize that there were certain fault lines that they maybe didn't even realize existed. I mean, you know, we sort of have always had this kind of implicit belief that America was a classless society or something, and I think maybe that this might kind of shake that up a bit. There's obviously a big suburban-urban cut that's very obvious, to the point now where political scientists, I've seen several books recently arguing about whether the critical vote is the suburban vote, or is it the blue-collar vote in the cities and stuff. And again, that's, to some extent, that's a matter of strategy as well, you know, which one you want to concentrate on.
Speaking of strategy, I wanted to get your take on how you evaluate the strategy of Mr. Bush and Mr. Gore in how they handled those weeks in the aftermath of the election, where the results were sort of hanging in the air. Do you think that they and their handlers, their advisors, handled that situation well? Did one handle it better than the other? What was your take at the time and now in retrospect?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First of all, I guess I'd like to preface it by saying that you can't imagine two people being under more pressure during that period, I suppose, than in some ways it was a good test for who was president. I just happened to see 13 Days a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
And thinking about that, you know, that the kind of pressure that they were under at that particular point, it wasn't quite as great, but in terms of its personal impact, it was probably just as great on those candidates. Personally, I think the Gore people made a mistake right off the bat with Florida by not just simply demanding a complete recount of the entire state rather than doing it this little bit at a time. And I think that there were times when both candidates and their entourage gave the impression that they only wanted to count those areas where they thought they would pick up votes and so on, which I know is natural enough, but I think most times people are sophisticated enough to try to cover that up a little bit. But, you know, on the whole, I think considering the kind of pressure they were under, I thought they comported themselves pretty well. You know, there were those flashpoint moments like Gore calling and congratulating Bush and then calling him later and pulling it back and all that. But I think a lot of that goes back to the way that the television media, again, I guess we're on radio, we can criticize the television media, can't we?
please do.
The way in which they handle this whole thing. I mean, they seem to be absolutely determined, you know, to project winners rather than just simply report the news as it develops, I think. And I think that created, clearly that created a lot of problems. I remember distinctly sitting in my dining room, working at the dining room table, and there was that whole run of eastern states that were projected for Gore, and then they projected Florida, and this was like about 7:30 at night, and I said, well, you know, the election's over at this point, you know, clearly Gore's won. Then a while later, of course, they take it back, and then they gave it to him, and they took it back, and all of that kind of stuff. So I don't know. They still seem determined to make those projections. I mean, it would be one thing if they don't even present them as predictions. They present them as you know, they're calling this thing as if they have enough data to really do that at that particular point. So I think they kind of do. That needs to be looked at really carefully. I mean, obviously putting. You know, restricting what broadcasters do is always a very tricky area, and so on. But
they seem to be resistant to that. Yeah. But it's to me, one of the things that was interesting about that is, I mean, it's one thing when an accountant someplace in a little cubicle makes a mistake that maybe their boss knows about or certain colleagues. It's another thing when you make a mistake of that magnitude, and millions and millions and millions of people. See that with their own eyes. I mean, there is no running away from that kind of a mistake, and that was in itself. It was, you know, like an extraordinary spectacle we just aren't used to seeing.
Right. Well, in some ways it was nice. In some ways it had its positive aspects because I think it showed that you know, nothing is, as they always say in sports, that's why they play the game. I mean, you know, you don't just project on the basis of who's on what team and what their records are and stuff, but. But I think you need to play the game. You need to, you know, you need to see the thing come out. But you know, also I think that they need. I think it would be nice if there were some voluntary agreements on the part of the television media, not to, you know, jump in there with both feet.
In terms of the media, I wonder if in the aftermath, your reaction to those analysts and so on. Who really threw around the word crisis
mm-hmm.
rather freely. I mean, you certainly had some that were not calling it a crisis situation at all, and others that really seemed swept up in the events, and to me that was a very interesting thing as well, to see one body of experts saying, we're okay, let this play out, and others saying, oh my gosh, we are teetering on the brink of utter chaos.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's the way a lot of stuff are handled. You watch the 10 o'clock news, and they'll tell you every night that there's going to be some tremendous thing that may affect your health or your pocketbook, and then it turns out that it's something that's pretty commonplace and everybody knows about already anyway. Also, I guess some of them were in the same position, I guess, usually. I always think of it as sports announcers, like people doing the Super Bowl, trying to make you believe that it was actually a football game, that it was actually in doubt or something. You know? I mean,
yeah, right.
That's what they get paid for. You know?
Right, right.
Yeah. So in fact, I kept saying that, you know, there really isn't any crisis. I mean, the only crisis date is January 20th at noon. I mean, when you have a new president, up till then, everything is doable. You know, and so yeah, I think there was a lot of that, the scare tactics kind of thing. I mean, I don't know why they did it, if it was done because they sincerely thought so, but if you look at some of the other constitutional crises we've had over the years, it certainly didn't come anywhere near Watergate
right.
or anything like that.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a morning show interview from February 2nd, 2001, which I had the pleasure of doing with Dr. John Bunker, longtime history professor at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. We're replaying this interview today in his memory. He passed away on April 4th.
Professor Bunker, you just got done saying that as long as we have a president by January 20th, everything is okay. Of course, one of the consequences of the this sort of protracted election analysis and count and recount and so on was some delay in now President Bush being able to prepare for his new administration, but all the public signs are that things are operating smoothly already at this point in time. What's your sense of that so far?
Well, I think it might be, to go back to the beginning, there was originally a much larger gap between the election and presidents were inaugurated on March 4th until the 1930s, and then we brought it up to January 20th. I think one of the arguments, since the Bush people were so successful in putting a cabinet together so quickly, maybe that's a good argument for narrowing the gap even more. I mean, most other countries, most European countries, the new government takes over within a week after the election results or something like that. So, I mean, you know, we have a time frame that really began in the 18th century and was updated in the early 20th century and really hasn't been looked at since, which I think may be another thing that we might really need to do with this. The other thing is, of course, that the reason that they can do that in those other countries is that they have a much different kind of party system, and most of the parties in those countries have what they call shadow cabinets, so that you actually have someone in your party who is the expert on foreign policy, whose job it is to keep track of what the Secretary of State does, you know, in our and to prepare critiques of what he does, so that members in Parliament or whatever can then provide, you know, can ask questions and stuff, so that when an election is held and the party takes over, they already know who are going to be in all of those positions, because these people have basically been functioning that way all the way down the line. And also, of course, they don't need a whole lot of briefing on what's going on, because although they obviously don't agree with most of the policies that the other party had, they are certainly familiar with all the issues and have their own counter policies and so on. So I think that it's kind of the haphazard nature of our... Also, of course, you can't fathom what kind of cabinet a president... I mean, there's part of me that says a president should be entitled to have whatever cabinet he wants, and if we had a system that was like the one I was describing, then that would make perfectly good sense. But it seems to me that one of the ways you have of gauging what a president's going to do is who he picks for his cabinet. And you really don't know that when you vote, because you have no idea in our system what that's going to really be like. So that's one of the indications, you know, that we have so far of what to expect from the Bush administration.
And I was just going to ask you, what have we already learned about what is ahead from his cabinet choices?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, he certainly has, he sort of went Clinton one better in terms of picking a cabinet that looked more like America in one sense. But in another sense, I think there are a lot of people left over from his father's administration, or, you know, being brought back from his father's administration. So it's kind of a curious mix that way. And, you know, there's certain... Most of the appointments are, a lot of the people were not terribly well known, but, you know, people have, the ones that are retreads have a record. For example, Mr. Rumsfeld, who, you know, has always been an advocate of strong defense, even advocating the so-called Star Wars initiative and so forth. Then you have, you know, certain people like Christine Whitman, you know, people are not going to be concerned about. But I guess the two biggest appointments that concerned a lot of people were the Secretary of the Interior, Ms. Norton, and then, of course, the Ashcroft one, which was just voted on yesterday. I noticed I was looking at the vote in the Chicago Tribune this morning. It was 58-42,
I guess,
eight Democrats, including Senator Feingold, who actually voted for Ashcroft, which I found rather surprising. But
there was an interesting photo of him. I think I can't remember now if it was the Kenosha News that ran it, a picture of him, and he happened to be kind of standing alone with some other congressmen far behind him, and the headline of it was Feingold Stands Alone, and just a little discussion on his decision to vote for Ashcroft, flying in the face, of course, of many of his fellow Democrats who have a lot of trouble with him.
Well, I think, you know, in some ways Feingold is a traditional Wisconsin independent, or maverick, as I like to call him. I mean, he certainly follows in the tradition of Proxmire and both La Follette's and people like that. And, you know, I'd be curious to hear his reasoning, though, as to why he voted that way, if he just did it out of senatorial courtesy or courtesy to the new administration. I can't believe that he shared very many of Mr. Ashcroft's views, and he certainly doesn't seem to. So it'd be interesting to see what, how he did that. And of course, Cole voted against the nomination. Most of the other people, the other Democrats, except for Senator Dodd from Connecticut, I think the rest of them were all Southerners, I think, and for whatever significance that has. So that might be kind of intriguing. I think it's pretty clear, though, that President Bush is going to have a much shorter honeymoon than most presidents. I mean, the circumstances under which he was elected, and then some of the controversies surrounding a couple of the cabinet nominations.
Yeah,
already.
Yeah.
And then there are the, some of the initiatives that he's put forward. I mean, one of the very first ones involving abortion funding, I think, created a lot of controversy. And then, of course, appointing an attorney general who has generally been opposed to Roe versus Wade, you know, very upfront about it, seems to be sending another, you know, a similar message. Then there's the school voucher thing is going to be, is already very controversial. I've heard lots of people talk about that. And also the idea of the faith-based, giving money to faith-based, as they're now called, you know, organizations. The Clarence Page in the Washington Post had a really good editorial about that the other year, column, because he said, you know, as an African American, he was well aware of the fact that the church had played a critical role, in, particularly in northern cities, of helping African Americans adjust and find jobs and work and housing and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you know, he was concerned about the idea of separation, using federal funds or, you know, tax dollars, you know, to go to religious institutions. So that's a very tricky area. And I think that it's one that's going to cause a lot of controversy as well. All of those areas are, I think.
It does strike me that, and I wonder if you agree, that Bush is really showing some aggressiveness here in the early going. He's not shying away from some hot button topics for whatever reason. He's already full steam ahead here.
Yeah, I think that seems pretty clear. There are a couple of things that, you know, the intriguing thing, of course, is that the right wing of the Republican Party, particularly so-called religious right, to some, which is part of it at least, seemed to be relatively quiet during this campaign. And so then there's always been the question of, you know, did Bush kind of buy them off in the sense that, you know, he promised them to do certain things in order when he got elected, and that therefore they didn't really raise too many serious objections, and apparently did vote for him. So that's one way of looking at it. But yeah, I think he definitely did not waste any time in putting some of these things forward. Of course, that is going to shorten the honeymoon period,
right.
I think even more so. And then, of course, I think the next big issue that's looming is the tax cut. I noticed you had a copy of the Wall Street Journal out there I was looking at earlier, and clearly there was a lot of talk about that already. And if he puts forward the kind of tax cut that he was talking about during the campaign, it's going to really solidify a lot of opposition, I think, mostly from Democrats, but even, I think, from some more moderate Republicans, I think, who are going to be really, really unfavorably disposed toward that, I think. So, yeah, I think it's going to be the old Chinese curse. I think it's going to get interesting pretty fast.
Yeah, right. Interesting is not always good, but
right.
I think of a book like George Stephanopoulos, All Too Human. He paints a picture of the early days of the Clinton administration that I just find endlessly fascinating, in that those of them that were on the inside in those early days of the administration, at the time, you know, found themselves just caught up in something very exciting, and you know, like a thrill ride in a sense. And now, more in retrospect, they kind of realized that in fact was an administration in a lot of chaos in the early going, a lot of newcomers to Washington that really had very little sense of how things operate or how you get things done, where are the connections, and this and that. And his sense was that eventually, you know, that ship really righted itself, but it took some time.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that we're probably not talking about that with this Bush administration, that these are people that know Washington and the paths of power very, very well.
Yeah, in fact, the irony of all that, of course, is that Bush presented himself as an outside-the-beltway candidate when, in fact, he had a grandfather who was a United States senator and a father who was president and various other things. So, I mean, he clearly is an inside-the-beltway person and had plenty of, and many of the people that are his advisors. I mean, Dick Cheney certainly is an inside-the-beltway person. So, yeah, I think there's probably be a little bit less of that that kind of scrambling around. Of course, the job of the PR people is to make all these things look like they're going smoothly when all the world is going apart, falling apart, you know, in the interior. So you sometimes can't tell until you get some of these inside stories, which usually don't come out till somewhat later. Obviously, remember, like, Clinton stepped in a couple of real landmines right off the beginning, the whole homosexuality and the military thing that actually helped bring down Les Aspin, I think, in his attempt to be Secretary of Defense. And then, of course, the healthcare business, which was probably the thing that Clinton had the clearest mandate for when he was elected in 1992, or at least so it seemed anyway. And that got bungled for whatever
reason. Yeah, that seems like that may be the bitterest of his defeats.
And it may have pushed him even more toward, I mean, he ran as a centrist New Democrat, and I think that the defeat of that probably pushed him even more towards the center or towards the right. And then, of course, very quickly in 94 congressional elections, he ended up getting a Republican majority in both houses of Congress, which kind of forced him to go in that direction. He didn't know if he's going to get anything at all done that he thought was important.
I'm glad we touched on Clinton, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you before we finished this leg of our discussion is to ask you what you would predict the role of Clinton is going to be now in public discourse, in public life, since at the moment the only job he holds is his husband of a U.S. senator.
Which has not been a terribly visible job.
right.
For most people, yeah.
But what is your educated expert guess as far as the kind of role Clinton is going to play in the political scene in the next couple of years?
Well, one thing based on his personality is I doubt he'll go quietly into the night. I mean, I think he's going to probably try to find some way to stay in the spotlight. I mean, that's pretty much what he does. On the other hand, I think he's going to be very careful trying not to upstage his wife, I think, and I think Hillary will be there to remind him that he shouldn't be doing that as well. But I think there's also the fact that we historically very underutilized ex-presidents. I mean, now, there was a time a while back when we had like six or seven ex-presidents, and none of them had any governmental function. In fact, I think John Quincy Adams, as far as I know, is the only one who ever came back, and he was elected to the House of Representatives after he had been president. And,
right.
That's almost unique, I think. So we really underutilize them. You have a person like Jimmy Carter, who's carved out a real career. Some people have said he's the greatest ex-president we ever had. And
I've heard people say he's a better ex-president than he was president.
There's clearly no doubt about that. I think. And so, I think that Clinton will probably spend some time trying to figure out how he can best do that. I mean, Clinton is a campaigner. I mean, I was suggesting to people somewhat facetiously that Gore should have just let Clinton do all the campaigning for him. In fact, I think that was another strategic mistake that Gore people made, was they kept, Clinton's clearly a polarizer, but on the other hand, campaigning is something that he's enormously successful at, and they probably should have used him more. I think it probably would have benefited them more in the long run. But I'm sure that, like most vice presidents, Gore was trying to get himself out from under the shadow of the president and campaign as his own person, so to speak, but apparently his own person didn't quite pull it off, so. But Bill will be around, I'm sure. I mean, he's only, what, early 50s or something like that?
Right.
So I recall several years ago that when Clinton was elected president, the people who were at the inauguration, one of them was then-Governor Edgar of Illinois, and Jim Edgar said that he felt old because Clinton was actually a couple of years younger than him. And I said to a couple of friends, well, Jim Edgar was my student at Eastern Illinois University, so how old does that make me?
Wow. Boy, that makes you stop and think, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. But Clinton is going to be, he'll find a role, I think, that he feels comfortable with. Part of the question will be whether within the Democratic Party is an interesting question of, is this the end of the centrist New Democrat movement? I mean, is the party going to move back more to its more traditional, a little bit more left of center place? And, of course, that that makes a big deal of difference as far as how they're going to utilize Clinton. I mean, he's very definitely identified with that movement.
Will he be seen as an kind of an outmoded model of a bygone era, even if that bygone era is 2 years ago? Or
To be perfectly honest, I think there are a lot of Democrats who were quite happy to see Gore defeated, and you know, the last thing in the world they would want is for him to try to be a serious candidate for the nomination 4 years from now, because I think that, you know, the people who are more leftist oriented, I think, feel that, that this is a repudiation of the. But then, of course, the centrist people will say, well, you know, it's just that we didn't have enough centrism, and therefore we need even more of it. So that there'll be that fight, as there is. Both parties have their wings, and you know, I think Bush by nature, I think, is a compromiser, a conciliator, and facilitator. But he's dealing with, in his party, he's got to deal with a lot of these right-wing people that he, I think, is not philosophically very attuned to. And then, of course, on the Democratic side, he's got a lot of people that are, you know, much farther to the left than he's willing to go. So it's going to be a. I remember a reporter asking me right after the election that Bush had a lot of success bringing Texas Democrats and Republicans together. And I said, yeah, but Texas Democrats aren't New York Democrats, I mean, or California Democrats. I mean, you know, they're pretty much centrist Democrats by disposition, whereas you're talking about these other kind of Democrats are much more in the traditional Democratic mode, I think, of the 30s and 60s and so on. And they're not, you know, they're not going to accept that kind of middle-of-the-road stuff nearly as easily, I don't think.
So there's a wider chasm facing President Bush.
I think there definitely
than is. Than Governor Bush had to deal with.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
In the closing minutes of our conversation today, I wanted us to talk a little bit about what's ahead for you. You've been granted a year-long sabbatical beginning in the fall to embark on what sounds like a really interesting research project. Involving a figure out of Wisconsin history that is much more obscure than he really should be, considering his influence, a gentleman by the name of Charles McCarthy. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, well, it's the name. If you say the name, if you connect the name McCarthy with Wisconsin, obviously the name that occurs to you is not Charles, but rather Joe. And even when you say Charles McCarthy, as I mentioned to you earlier, a lot of people associate it with Edgar Bergen and his dummy. But Charles McCarthy is a fascinating person who probably, I would say at least in my own opinion, was probably more responsible for the successes of making Wisconsin the most progressive state in the Union in the early part of the 20th century. He was at least as important as Robert La Follette and some other people in actually accomplishing that, because he was the founding director of the Legislative Reference Library, and it was his agency that drafted almost all of the legislation that Wisconsin became famous for. And then he wrote all of that up in a book called The Wisconsin Idea, which had wide national circulation. In fact, the preface to the book was written by Teddy Roosevelt, and it definitely made Wisconsin, gave Wisconsin the reputation of being the most progressive state in the Union for quite some time. So I think he's, in addition to that, I think he was very much, and this is, I think, a part that I really want to stress in the book. It's what I got the grant for writing the proposal, so I assume that it's worth pursuing, is that McCarthy was very much connected both nationally and internationally with a group of intellectuals and politicians, and I guess what we'd call today policy wonks, I guess, who actually were designing laws and different kinds of agencies and so forth that actually are put in place all over the U.S. And even I know from looking at McCarthy's correspondence that he frequently corresponded with people in Great Britain, with people on the continent, particularly in Germany and Denmark, and in New Zealand, and even in Japan. McCarthy,
wow.
Among other things, McCarthy had been an All-American football player at Brown University, 135-pound fullback, if you can imagine. It says a lot about what football was in those days.
No kidding. You'd be lucky to be a punter now if you were 135.
Exactly. Well, he was. He's still famous for being the first Brown player to score a touchdown against Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. I guess no one had ever done that before. Brown was kind of like the weak sister of the Ivy League in those days. And so, and then when he came to Madison, he got his Ph.D. in history and political science. And then when he was looking around for an academic job, the legislature had decided, this was the same year that La Follette was elected governor the first time, they had decided to come up with, to create this bureau that would provide information for legislators writing bills, you know, so that they could get a lot of background information and also have some help drafting the bills. And a couple of his professors suggested to him that instead of taking an academic job, that he might be better suited for that. There was a certain amount of snobbery involved in that. McCarthy came from a poor Irish Catholic immigrant family in Massachusetts, and grew up in the same town as Rocky Marciano later.
Oh, my.
And his mother ran a boarding house, and his father worked in a shoe factory and so forth. So he really, you know, culturally and as far as social class was concerned, he didn't fit in to be an academic in those days. You pretty much had to be come from an upper middle class family. Most people were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and I think that there was this sense that McCarthy, among his professors, that McCarthy was kind of a diamond in the rough. He's a very intelligent person, a man of great ability and ambition and initiative, but you know, his social graces were not going to fit in at the, normally at the college level. So they put him in that position, and that put him in that position to be able to interact with all of those people at those other levels. He maintained his interest in sports, incidentally. He helped coach the Wisconsin football team for a while and actually coached the baseball team. He took he took the baseball team to Japan in 1909, and they played a number of exhibition games against Japanese teams. But while he was there, he also spent some time talking to people in government positions and so on, and getting some background information on what was going on in Japan, and also conveying to the Japanese some of the things that had been happening in the United States, and specifically in Wisconsin. Of course, I'm team teaching a class with Professor Hayward this semester on U.S.-Japanese relations, and one of the things that Oliver keeps stressing is that the Japanese were incredibly curious about the Western world, and they were, of course, wanted to learn all they could and borrow and adapt to their own uses. And so I'm sure that somebody like McCarthy would have been fascinating for them to deal with.
He's
really, and then of course he was also, his advice on politics was sought by many prominent politicians, both in Wisconsin and out. Particularly in 1912, he was an advisor to both Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt. They both asked for his advice on a number of things. He helped draft the Progressive Party platform in 1912 that Teddy Roosevelt ran on, and so on. So it's hard for me to imagine why he's kind of dropped out of the... Maybe it's simply because La Follette has loomed so large in Wisconsin history that maybe, you know, everyone else kind of tends to recede into the background. Hmm. But
when did McCarthy die?
He died very young in 1921. He was only 47 or 48 years old. I think he literally worked himself to death. He was a workaholic.
Sounds like it.
In fact, he said the if you read the Wisconsin Idea, it's a very cut and paste job book, and he admitted as much that he worked on it at night and on weekends, and he did the whole thing in a fortnight, as he said. And since he was regularly working 12-hour days, you can imagine, and probably at least 6 days a week, if not seven. So you can imagine that, it was kind of a slap-and-dash kind of job. It always made me feel bad that he didn't take the time to really write the thing out and really connect his ideas and, you know, connect the dots. In fact, that's one of the things I have this ambition to do, is to actually kind of rewrite the Wisconsin Idea based on his correspondence and other kinds of things, you know, to really connect up those things that he didn't bother to do. I think I think he's underrated as a progressive thinker, because he never took the time to really write out any of this stuff. You know, he just did it in bits and pieces and so forth.
Right.
So hopefully I can do something like that. That's one of the things I hope to do. Anyway.
So where will you probably be spending most of your time then during this this upcoming year?
Well, dividing my time between here and the State Historical Society. I mean, all of his papers and so on are obviously up there. However, we have this, Parkside is part of the State Historical Society's Area Research Center program. So, I mean, we have most of the records that relate to Racine and Kenosha County, but we also have access to most of the other records that they have up there. And we have a shuttle system that goes back and forth. I've gone through a lot of McCarthy's papers for an earlier book that I was working on, A up through about 1915, and most of those were simply brought, they brought them down here, and I could use them in the archives, and so that's probably, I also want to spend some time at the Legislative Reference Library. There's particularly a man who just retired from there named Jack Stark, who has been, was there for like 30 years or so, and he's very knowledgeable about Wisconsin law and the evolution of, particularly of the tax system and so on. He's written about that, and he has a lot of interesting anecdotes about McCarthy and you know, the, how he's regarded, you know, the legends that go on and that went on in the Bureau and stuff. So I want to spend a lot of time talking to Jack and then talking to people that he puts me on to and stuff to do that too. So
this will culminate in a book.
Eventually, that's my goal, yeah, is to come up with a book. There have been a couple biographies of McCarthy. One was written by one of his disciples, Edmund Fitzpatrick, back in the 1940s, and it's pretty much a hagiography. That is, I mean, he obviously thought McCarthy was
walked
a genius.
On water.
Yeah, walked on water, and it makes pretty clear. Then recently, there, about 10 years ago, there was a book written about him as a librarian, and it was published by the American Library Association. It's a good book, but it's pretty narrow in focus, and it doesn't really get into a lot of the issues, particularly his political role and his connections in these international and national reform circles and so on, which is really what I want to emphasize.
So we need you to come along and do it right.
Well, at least for this, I've lived long enough. I've suddenly discovered now that in recent years that people are writing books, revising things that I did 30 years ago, and you know, so when I was young and I was the revisionist, and you know, now you get some other people. But that's the way history works. It's the way knowledge is
keeps it alive.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So revisionism is what it's all about, actually. So.
Yeah. Well, when you look for a title for this book, you're going to have to get librarian and fullback into the title, because right there is going to send copies sailing off the shelf, I would think. I mean, that says a lot about the guy right there, that he was broke the typical molds.
He certainly did. He doesn't fit any of the molds, particularly of that time, because I think people in the positions that he had pretty much came from a pretty circumscribed segment of society, and he certainly didn't do that. In fact, my tentative title for the first chapter is The Quintessential Marginal Man. He really had, you know, as a working class Irish man for the United States Senate as a Democrat, even though, of course, the Progressive Party in Wisconsin was solidly Republican, and he worked for the Republican Party, so it was kind of hard to tell, you know, what his politics were. He always insisted that he was interested only in policy, and it didn't matter to him, you know, who put it into effect.
That sounds pretty refreshing.
Yeah,
for somebody to be in the political arena, not much interested in politics, because we're just drowning in politics now, aren't we?
Unfortunately, we have all the worst of politics, and not any of the best of it. It seems
that's
to
well
be
put.
At the moment, yeah.
And well put. Well, we really appreciate your time in offering your thoughts on this most recent presidential election and what is likely ahead in this George W. Bush presidency, and certainly wish you the very best in this exciting research that you'll be undertaking, and we'll certainly want to have you here on the morning show at some point in time to give us an update, and we'll look forward to the book that results.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to doing it again.
Great. We'll look forward to having you back. Mm-hmm. Professor John Bunker from the History Department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside.
Dr. John Bunker, a history professor at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside for 33 years. Professor Bunker died on April 4th. This conversation we replayed today dates from February 2nd, 2001. I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to welcoming back to our program a good friend of The Morning Show, psychotherapist Amy Champeau, who will offer some thoughts on what she has experienced during the COVID-19 crisis and some suggestions for all of us on how we can weather this crisis in a way that keeps our mental and emotional health intact. I look forward to sharing that interview with you tomorrow. On Thursday, I'll continue my series of conversations with instructors here at Gateway Technical College on what it has been like to shift over to a format of entirely online teaching. That will be on Thursday. And on Friday, some news that has nothing to do with COVID-19 whatsoever. Dr. Peter Dene from the music faculty at Carthage has just been awarded a Fulbright grant to study and do research and work in Tanzania next year. And we will talk with him about the arduous application process that is part of gaining a Fulbright and what he hopes to accomplish during his time in Tanzania. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Info at carthage.edu/aspire. And support comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive